Welcome, everybody, to Sight for Sound Life Coaching with a Twist. Thank you for being here today on Tuesday, August 14th. And my show is Sight for Sound. When you see things as they truly are, you make sound choices and live a sound life. We have a special guest today. His name is Jeremy Newman, an international motivational speaker, professional fitness trainer, and world-class athlete. This man is amazing and a great model for human potential. I want to talk to you first a little bit about coaching. I'm a life coach. I teach leadership, and I work with private one-on-one clients. I also work with organizations and small companies. So I want to share a little bit about me and my purpose and talk about coaching, what coaching is, and then we're going to bring in Jeremy. He's going to share his miraculous story and with the intention of inspiring all the listeners. So my purpose in life is inspiring human potential, and I have always believed that every human being has this amazing potential that it's just untapped. And I think it's limitless. I've always believed in it, and I still believe in it. And I guess until the day I die, I will be committed to inspiring people to live in their potential. I think it's very important that we all fully express ourselves and contribute our unique gifts. I think we're all unique. We all have unique gifts that lend themselves to strengthening the fabric of goodwill. And one of the first steps is to discover who we are through a process of self-awareness, which I bring people through in the coaching. Once we discover who we are, we begin to feel alive and fulfilled, and again, we make sound choices. And when we make sound choices, healthy choices, then we strengthen the fabric of goodwill. Let's see, life coaching with a twist. So my twist is, it has to do with photography. And I discovered maybe 5 years ago the internal process of transformation, when a person begins to know themselves and they begin to transform. They begin to express themselves. They begin to shine, and their essence is permeating. And one day, I was looking through photographs of myself from years gone by, and I never really liked the pictures of me. I always said they never captured my essence. At one point, I was blaming it on the photographers. But it wasn't the photographers. It was me being unwilling to really shine. And after a couple of years of doing some self-realization work, I was looking at a picture of myself in that process and said, hey, now that is capturing my essence. And then it just hit me right in that moment that what's on the inside actually shows up on the outside. So the way that we carry ourselves physically, our shoulders, our chest are more open. Perhaps we have more life in the eyes. The skin is more taut. You know that saying, why the long face? Well, the face is it's not really short, but it's not long. And so I incorporated that into my coaching. And it's a fun, tangible result for my clients to have. It's great to see the before and after pictures. It provides a fun, artistic, and creative mode for the coaching. And so what is coaching? Coaching, to me, is results-based and forward-moving. And it is a relationship with someone like myself who is an objective mirror. And as your mirror, you tend to see things you don't want to see. You tend to see things that you like to see that you don't pay attention to. You tend to hear things that you do not like to hear, and you tend to hear things that you really like to hear, but you just never paid attention to it. So as a coach, I'm really your objective mirror. And the process is fun. The process is confidential. and that creates a comfortable space for my clients to really participate in the process and get the most value. Results-based forward moving. So coaching is not therapy. It is not counseling. It's not advice. And it's a process where I ask you series of questions so that you get to thinking and you come up with the answers on your own. So if I were to give you the answers, then you wouldn't really own your realizations of yourself. So that's what coaching is. You can visit my website, sightforsound.com, to find out more information about my services. I do work with all kinds of different clients, one-on-one, single moms, to real estate investors, to artists, to entrepreneurs, to nonprofit organizations, etc. And I love my work. My work is extremely rewarding. I love working. I love it. It's not even like work to me. And right in this moment, I have deep gratitude for those who have been instrumental in where I am today, and that includes my family and mom, dad, my sister, my brothers, and all the kids, and also Randy and Judy Revelle, the late Randy Revelle, Judy Revelle of Context Associated, and Lori Marcoux and Phil Holcomb of Extraordinary Learning. And these people are my mentors and were my teachers, or have been my teachers, still are my teachers, in the last six or seven years in which I have gone through a transformational period myself and have started my coaching practice. And they're amazing people to know, and thank you. If you're listening, thank you. So I want to talk a little bit about the foundation of my teaching, and then we'll bring on Mr. Jeremy Newman. The foundation of my teaching is ownership and choice. Ownership is opposite of the victim role. And basically, in society, we are conditioned to play the victim role, whether we're aware of it or not. And stepping into a place of ownership creates a sense of freedom, and freedom is the pathway to live in our potential. And part of that piece in ownership is choice, and that knowing that we have choice in every moment. We have choice in every moment creates a sense of freedom. Choosing how we think, what we're thinking of, choosing how we feel, choosing how we speak, choosing to own our results, choosing where we live, choosing our friendships, choosing everything. And once we get to a place of really stepping into that powerful place that I have choice in every moment, and that really opens up the doors to live in a sense of freedom. And again, in that sense of freedom, we are living in our potential, and there's great joy and happiness in that path. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce Jeremy Newman, who I've known for almost a year, and this man is a miracle, I think, and he is the epitome of ownership and a human being living in their potential. We met at the Self-Realization Fellowship last year. And it was the first time that he actually walked into that temple. And the brother stopped the sermon and pointed out Jeremy, and we all stood up and all moved to tears and inspired. So I introduced myself to Jeremy Newman, asked him if I could interview him for my book. And he gladly did, and we have become very good friends since then. And Jeremy, I would love for you to share your story with the audience. And then what we're going to do is open up the lines for questions. You are free to ask me questions. You are free to ask questions to to Jeremy. Welcome.
Thank you, Janet. I feel like there should be a little bit of understanding of the fact that I wasn't the first time I actually walked into Lake Shrine Temple. Actually, I suppose it was the first time in 10 years that I walked into Lake Shrine, because for the last 10 years I've been using a wheelchair, and it really was a miraculous moment, and it shifted my life as well. But a little bit of background of who I am, where I come from. I was born in New York City, and I live what I like to refer to as a blessed life. My father, he was an alcoholic. He committed suicide when I was 2 years old. My mother remarried very shortly thereafter, while pregnant with my first sister, to another alcoholic who physically abused me for about 8 years as a child. And a friend of the family sexually abused me. And I was diagnosed with a learning disability in fifth grade, and I was removed from public school and had to go to a private school. And I was dealing with a lot of mental, psychological, and physical issues. Growing up, I was very overweight. I was a fat, chubby little kid with pimples and buck teeth, and I didn't keep myself very clean, and you know, I didn't brush my hair much. It's a very different person than the person who I've become. However, I also began experimenting with drugs at a very young age and got myself into quite a bit of trouble. And one of the things that I actually enjoyed about getting into trouble was that I got attention, because as a kind of a fat, out of shape little kid, I was ostracized from people because I was bullied. The bullies picked on me, and people didn't really want to be my friend, because if you were my friend, you got picked on by the bullies as well. So when I got in trouble from the school or the law or whatever with my family, it was exciting because I got attention. I was paid attention to, and it was kind of a twisted way in which to get noticed, but it worked. When I found fitness, or I should say sports, I really found myself in grade school. I began in eighth grade doing gymnastics, and I did gymnastics all through high school, and it really shaped me, not just physically, but emotionally and kind of spiritually. I also created a career out of it. My coach taught me how to exercise and take care of myself, and also sort of taught me how to take care of the other people on the team, and I created a career out of it, and I became a personal trainer when I was 17 years old. And I did that for a long period of time. I, in addition to working in nightclubs as a doorman in New York City, and I got myself into a bit of trouble with the law as well. I was a bit of a rebel. And I moved to California in 1995 for a number of different reasons, but really the weather was the most appealing of everything. And I started my personal training business over again out here. But even with all the, I was racing a motorcycle around town, and I drove not just around California, but around the country as if I owned it. And I kind of made up the rules. And even though I was doing all these amazing, wonderful things, or so I thought, life kind of sort of felt empty. And I did some very dangerous things. Like I'd go cliff diving and bungee jumping and racing my motorcycle. But one day in February of 1997, I found something that I had been looking for, which was the ability to do gymnastics again without the possibility of getting hurt. Well, so I thought, I went skydiving, and it shifted my life at that time. I was ready to give up the fitness industry that I had been practicing for well over 15 years, for well over 10 years, and I wanted to become a stuntman. So I was doing it every weekend, skydiving. It was incredible. And Memorial Day weekend of 1997, I went specifically to get videotaped and was going to do some very specific stunts in the air. But when I got there, the it was kind of overcast, a little hazy out. It wasn't ideal blue skies to get videotaped. So I decided that I would just do some what's called fun runs, fun jumps. I met up with another guy from another country. He's from Korea, and we went up skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
And we rehearsed what we were going to do in the air, down on the ground. We got up in the plane, jumped out at 13,000 feet, did our little routine, and at 3,000 feet, we tracked away from one another, opened up our parachutes, and we began to descend toward the drop zone. He was a much more experienced skydiver than I was,
mm-hmm.
And he had a much smaller canopy than I did. And this allowed him to travel faster through the air than I was. And me being a very competitive person, I noticed that he was going faster than I was through the air, and I wanted to go faster too. So I did a very dangerous thing. I collapsed the end cells of my parachute. Now, this is something that very advanced skydivers would maybe do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very dangerous thing to do, especially at, you know, above 1,000 feet. And I was at about 1,500 feet at that time. And I collapsed my end cell successfully, and my parachute became a little smaller, and I began to travel faster through the air. But it wasn't fast enough. I tried to collapse the next set of cells. And ultimately what that did was it collapsed my entire canopy.
Mm-hmm.
So at 1,200 feet, I went back into free fall with nothing but a streamer above me. Now, what we're taught in skydiving school is anytime you have a complete malfunction, the first thing you do is you cut away and you pull your reserve chute. Well, what went through my mind in those milliseconds was knowing that if I pulled my reserve chute, I would have to answer to the people on the ground, why did I have to pull my reserve chute? And I would have to say, you know, I was screwing around trying to go faster. And also, again, in those milliseconds were the thoughts that in telling them that, people would look at me as a liability and not want to jump with me, thus replaying my childhood of being ostracized from the people that I wanted to surround myself with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I chose option B, which was fix the problem. So I'm up at, you know, coming down at just under 90 feet per second, kicking and spinning and pulling the lines apart, and my parachute is beginning to open, but not quickly enough. But I'm looking at my altimeter, which is above me on my wrist, and I'm pulling the lines apart, and I'm thinking I have a little bit more time, and I'm looking up at the parachute, it's not opening fast enough. So I realize it's time to pull the reserve chute. I've got not enough time left. And when I went to pull a reserve chute, it was too late. I hit the ground at about 100
miles an hour. 100
miles an hour. Yeah. That had quite an impact on my life. And I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek because not only did I make an impact in the ground, but it shifted the course of my life in an amazing way. And I speak of this as truly the best thing that ever could have happened to me. I believe that had I not hit the ground at 100 miles an hour, I would not be alive today. And at the time I hit the ground, I was virtually lifeless. I landed in someone's backyard who happened to be mowing his lawn. He came over to me and asked me if I was still alive, and I was unresponsive because mm-hmm. I collapsed both of my lungs. I could only breathe about 20%, so I could not speak. So he asked me if I was alive again, if I was alive to open my eyes. And that was how I then communicated with him and the paramedics once they arrived,
mm-hmm.
by blinking. I was rushed, and once the helicopter came and picked me up, I was rushed to the hospital. But while I was laying on the ground, prior to the helicopter getting there, there was a reel, if you will, like an audio reel traveling through my head, and
uh-huh.
it said, or I was saying, God was saying, the universe, whatever, everything's going to be okay, just keep yourself alive until help gets here. So I was listening to this over and over and over, hearing this inside my head, and I was just holding on for dear life. And once the helicopter paramedics got there and they strapped me to their backboard and got me on the helicopter, and they began to lift me off. And I relaxed. I knew I was safe.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, my heart stopped. And that's the moment where my memories end for an entire month. But I was rushed to the hospital. I underwent aortic surgery. I ruptured my aorta, collapsed both lungs, had severe head trauma, and a compound fracture of my femur. I underwent a 13-hour surgery to save my life and my heart, and it was the surgery that saved my life is what caused the paralysis.
Sure.
A small price to pay. However, nonetheless, I have been, as I said, in a wheelchair, using a wheelchair for the last 10 years. And by the grace of God and some miracles that have been occurring in my life, I'm relearning how to walk again. It's been a struggle, or not really a struggle, it's been a challenge, one after another. And I enjoy the challenges that I'm confronted with on a daily basis now.
Sure.
But at the time this occurred, I could not see how any of this was purposeful or there was any meaning in it other than I felt like a victim. Why me?
Mm-hmm.
How could this possibly be happening to me?
So at what point did you step into ownership and come out of that victim role?
That's a great question. My mother, God bless her, sat down on my hospital bed after she had recognized that I had been pushing people away from me, my family, my friends, even hospital staff. She sat down on my hospital bed and said, "Jeremy, you have a choice. You can sit in this hospital bed and live the rest of your life being angry, bitter, and alone. Or you can take what has happened and find what's positive in it and be in a positive space, and you'll be surrounded by people.
Mm-hmm.
People will want to be around you." At that moment, I wasn't ready to hear what she was saying, and I asked her to leave. And that next morning when I woke up, I was humbled, and the words of my mother were not just resounding, they were deafening. And
mm-hmm.
that was the moment that my life shifted, and I began to take ownership of my actions and how my actions didn't just impact my own life, but they impacted the world around me.
Sure.
And that has been, or I should say, that has become the commitment in my life to inspire people in recognizing how our own actions don't just impact ourselves, but they impact the world around us.
Your mother is a wise woman when she presented to you that you had choice.
Yes.
And revisiting that conversation about choice. And we might not like our options. We might not like the choices that are available to us, but we still have choice. And we can choose. And the good news is we can re-choose and choose again.
It's absolutely. Doesn't always feel like we have a choice.
No, and the law of nature, the impermanence, which is really great news because, again, we can choose and we can choose and re-choose. And, sometimes it doesn't seem like we have a choice, but we do. And that really is the point here in this conversation, is that you did have a choice, but you absolutely at that time thought you had none, and even if you thought you had a choice, you probably didn't like any of it.
No, absolutely not. But it didn't take long. It really didn't take long for me to see the tangible benefits in making choices that were in line or in sync with the universe. And being surrounded by people when I'm positive and being ostracized when I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and It took you, what, a month or so to wake up and get out of the hospital?
I spent 2.5 months in the hospital, and for about a month I was in a coma, even though I was slightly functioning. I was in a drug-induced coma. In the next month and a half, I was dealing with a significant amount of pain, and I was having multiple surgeries on like having my gallbladder removed, and you know, dealing with coming off of being completely reliant on hospital staff and friends and people to assist me, to being able to finally sit up out of bed and then transfer mm-hmm. out of bed onto a wheelchair and learning how to use a wheelchair. It was an interesting challenge.
Well, I think one of the things you truly enjoy and have always enjoyed in your life is that experience, that juicy experience of challenge. Is that true?
Absolutely.
And what are your thoughts on meeting that juicy experience of challenge? Have you met that experience of challenge in an unhealthy way and in healthy ways?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've met that juicy challenge, juicy experience, you know, in both healthy and unhealthy ways. And they have been both serving and not so.
Sure. And just like I think another juicy experience for you is attention. And you certainly met it in an unhealthy way, I think, when you closed the end cells.
Yes. Yeah.
Or that might have been a mix of attention and the challenge, because you wanted to go faster than your partner there.
Well, yeah, I wanted to catch up with him. But that was just what I look at this having happened is my last chance. There were many other experiences that when I give when I have conversations in my speaking engagements, I talk about other experiences that have happened in my life that were opportunities for me to listen, and the universe was trying to speak to me. But mm-hmm. But there were many other opportunities for me to learn many lessons, but this was it. This was the last one, and this was it.
Okay. And so when your mom said that you had choice, and the next day you were humbled and you really understood that, what did you have a realization of your life purpose and your unique gift? And if so, did that support you in getting out of the victim role and getting into a place of ownership and just moving forward, just like coaching, results-based and forward-moving, no living, dragging the past around?
Well, you know, there was a very specific moment, that occurred when the shift took place in my life. I was laying in the bed, in the hospital bed, and I had woken up, and at the time, I had no bowel or bladder function. And when I had woken up, I had made a mess, number one and two all over me. And at the time, I was also too weak for me to clean myself. So I had to ring for the nurse to come in and clean me. And the nurse came in with her bucket and sponges. And I, at that moment, was experiencing humiliation, or mm-hmm. so I thought. And I, while she was doing her job, which was caring for me, I was feeling very uncomfortable and rushing her, and I telling her to hurry up, come on, aren't you finished yet? And she was not even close to being finished, and she dropped her sponge in the bucket and said, I don't need to put up with this, and she walked out. And it was at that moment that she walked out, I realized how much I needed not just her help, but other people, and mm-hmm. how I was impacting that experience. I became accountable for my actions at that moment, and that was the shift that began to take place.
Okay. And so what did you think about a purpose at that time to support you in moving forward?
The I don't know if there was a necessary conscious thought of a purpose other than when I began to use my feeling comfortable and feeling grounded and feeling good as a sort of a barometer to whether or not I was in sync with the universe. And when I started to feel like empty or alone or just off balance emotionally, I knew that this was not in sync. And I'm not quite sure if I'm answering your question.
You are answering it, and it wasn't necessary that you had a purpose in mind to support you in moving forward. You had other methods, other intentions in mind that supported you in moving forward.
Yeah, I still had a lot of evolving to do, but this was the beginning stages of that. I was coming from a completely selfish, self-serving life to being in the life and service of others.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that being of service to others, I think generally our purpose here is to contribute, our uniqueness, our gift, and bringing that in service to others. How have you balanced doing that and being good to yourself? You know, there's this piece that I really believe in, is that I'm as good to others to the degree I am with me.
Yeah.
And I think that's a selfless act, that if I'm really healthy with myself, then I actually have more to give to others, where I think in general we've been conditioned the opposite, to put everybody and everything first. So imagine if you put everybody and everything first before you, you wouldn't even be where you are today. So how do you balance that? And being good to Jeremy and staying good with Jeremy, so that you do have that energy, you do have that will to serve others.
Even today, I mean, I see how I oftentimes, I'm human. I am human, and I oftentimes find myself...
And you are humor.
Sometimes, yes. I find myself doing, still being somewhat extreme. And it wasn't long ago that I was so much, not, I was so concerned with serving others that I was injuring myself. I began racing again, participating in sports. I became a triathlete, which is a combination of three sports, swimming, biking, and running. And I became the first wheelchair triathlete on the West Coast, at least, to be doing triathlons. And I recognized it really was. At the time, I was doing it because it was sports and it was active and I was able to get out some aggressions, and it was fun. It got my endorphins spinning and it was really exciting. And it began to become a little addictive for me. I have slightly an addictive personality, and I enjoy it. However, it was a lot of fun and very exciting. Until I realized there were many times that I would have people coming up to me at the end of the race, hugging me and crying and thanking me for being there. And I was baffled. I could not understand where this was coming from. So I would get this quite often at races. And finally, I asked this woman. I was at a race in Santa Barbara, and she was sobbing and holding me and hugging me and thanking me for being there. And I after she was done, and I was all teared up. I looked at her and I said, why are you crying? And why are you thanking me? She said, when I was at mile 12 on the bike ride, after the swim, and we were on mile 12, the bike ride of 24 miles, she was experiencing a tremendous amount of discomfort, as most people are in triathlons, and she was done. She couldn't go on the bike any longer, and I passed her. I don't remember this, but I had passed her on the bike and gave her the thumbs up, a big smile, and said, you can do it. Mm. And this is my normal behavior when I'm racing. I'm encouraging other people, giving them the thumbs up, smiling, and telling them they can do it. Great job. Well, apparently for her, that it was enough to see me in a wheelchair doing exactly what she's doing, and I'm got a smile on my face and encouraging other people. She got back on the bike and finished the race. And we saw each other apparently on the run, and when she came across the run and she had finished the race that she thought that she was disqualifying herself for, you know, 10 miles, 15 miles before, was, you know, emotional for her. And then I understood why she and many other people were thanking me. And that became a new driving force for me about mm-hmm. 5 years ago. And racing took on a whole new meaning for me. And it was extraordinary because I was impacting people's lives in a positive way, and I was doing nothing more than something that I love doing. And
wonderful.
That was truly amazing. Yeah.
That's when it works, is when one is doing something that they love to do, and that's when others are inspired, and when others, you know, when they're about to quit, and then they say, no way, you know. I think that when we really, truly do what we love to do, there was a poster I had in my room for many years, and it said, do what you love, love what you do, and the world will come to you.
I agree.
And that is not an easy task to live by, but it is so true. It is really, it is very true. I want to give an opportunity to any of the listeners who would like to call in and ask questions to Jeremy or I.
That would be great.
See if anybody is calling in. If not, then we will continue.
You want to give them the number?
Sure. It's online, but it is 877-876-5227, 877-876-5227, and locally it is 530-876-3222, 530-876-3222. Call in and ask us questions. I don't hear any beeping.
That's okay. But then that probably means that we don't have any callers yet.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question that I would like to ask you. And one of the strong pieces in my teaching is around words, thoughts and words and language. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain bunch of words that I...
Taboo.
I strongly suggest people relinquish from their vocabulary, even if it's temporary, to play around with it and see what happens when they relinquish certain words and replace them, if necessary, with more like more ownership words, and to experiment with it and see what happens for them.
Sure.
And one of the things that I learned from In Context Associated, 21st Century Leadership, the most amazing one-week experiential leadership and personal development course ever on this planet, one of the things I took away is that as a human being, I am inherently able. And, you know, in my purpose of inspiring human potential and my belief in our potential, there's no question about ability in anybody. And if we use the word able or not able, there's an implication there's an implication there that we might not be able. And since I think that's not true, since I think that we are all able no matter what, I want to know. So I know for me that I chose to eliminate that word in any of its context from my vocabulary. And it really strengthened my confidence and my belief in myself and my level of ownership, because I think it's very unconscious, but some people do use that word. They use it in a context for not really taking ownership of their choices, like I'm not able to go to your party type thing. And well, we're able to go to the party, but we're choosing not to, so we come back to the ownership of choice. And it's really powerful when we step into our choices. So given that we are inherently able, or at least taking that on for the next 10 minutes with me, Jeremy, what are your thoughts on the word able?
I agree with what you're saying and how the words that we use, oftentimes, I know for me, are sometimes unconscious, but I make a choice to be conscious of the words that I'm saying and using. The word able, it's not a big word that I would use. It would be something that I stay away from because it doesn't resonate for me.
I think we have a caller.
Ooh.
Hello?
Is there someone on the line?
There is someone on the line.
Okay. Welcome.
Please introduce yourself.
Ike McGursky.
Well, thank you for calling.
No, this is actually Keith Davis, a friend of Jeremy Newman's, and I was listening. And I know this man very well, and I just had a couple comments and wanted to reconfirm all the things that he believes and says are show up in his life. He's not just talking about what he wants people to see in himself. He shows up every day and really is an example of the incredible lightness of being, which it's easy to take it for granted sometimes, but it's good to see that he always has a smile on his face and really capable of walking the walk, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
You bet.
Thank you. Or Mr. McGursky.
Yeah, you can explain that one, too.
Okay, yeah. just a little nickname that we've created.
A nickname. We train a lot together, so we have inside jokes.
and so, Keith, are you spend time with Jeremy. He's part of your life, and he's someone who supports you and the incredible lightness of being. Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, I think what's interesting about he and I is we share a similar approach to life, and we also share a similar physical indifference. I had a car accident about 17 years ago. And, you know, just to be a young man and faced with something like that, at some point you're going to have to get clear on what it's all about. If you feel entitled, or if you feel like a victim, or if you feel like you're owed something by this world or universe, it doesn't matter if it's a car accident or any indifference, you're going to come up short at some point. And some people get there quicker than others. And Jeremy got there as fast as anyone I know. And I was fortunate enough to have some good information after my injury and even before to make it make more sense. My mom used to call it being the dweller on the threshold. And I didn't know what that meant when I was younger, before my accident. I thought it sounded like a cool thing.
Putting the umbrella on the threshold?
Dweller on the threshold.
The dweller.
Oh, the dweller.
I was like, I want to be the dweller on the threshold. You know? And she goes, well, you're being it. You know, you're 13 years old and you don't want to clean your room or everything's wrong. And then when I finally figured out what it meant, I was like, oh, I actually, that's not a supportive place for me to be. I don't want to be dwelling, and I don't want to be on the threshold. I want to be through, and I want to be, you know, in support of myself and
sure.
what's coming my way. So we get to roll around in our wheelchairs and experience life on a different level and inspire people on a unique level, and then also be inspired by people's reaction to us, because we even take it for granted, living our lives independently and driving and shopping and going out and doing things. You know, it's just what we do to have fun.
Dancing.
And then when somebody comes up and says, "You are so amazing," if your ego is anywhere involved, we're trained not to take compliments or say, like, it's no big deal. And really, sometimes you got to go, well, thank you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
go, like, it's kind of cool. And you've got stuff in you that's kind of cool, too. So what's your thing that you hide, maybe, or your disability that you can shine through or break through? And then everybody can win. Jeremy
that's,
and I just
that's
kind
a great
of,
idea, because
yeah, exactly.
When we push off compliments, we're actually not acknowledging our greatness and our gifts, and the person who's thanking us is really truly inspired, and that's the gift. And to take that, to push it away or to not accept it, doesn't really serve a good purpose.
It's what I call poo-pooing on something. It's like
yeah.
poo-pooing.
You poo-poo it, you know. It's meant to how the universe works, right? It's as much as you give as you get. So if somebody hands you something and you don't take it, it creates a ripple in the fabric of the universe.
Sure.
And there's so many ripples right now. I don't think I need to be a part of creating any more. We are plenty
well,
ripples.
So when I take something, when I'm being given something like a compliment, do you think that that's an act of ownership?
Oh, definitely.
Absolutely.
And what I love, what I really appreciate about somebody standing in their power is when they can get to the point and take a compliment and not feel obligated to give one back, because that is not why that person did that.
Exactly.
And when you say, like, someone says, "Nice hair," and you're like, "Thanks, you too."
Yeah.
Just because it's a knee-jerk reaction, and that person's like, "That wasn't the deal."
It's still a
you
deflection.
Know? You took it, you know, and maybe you'll give me one later, and hopefully I can take it. But yeah, that can also poo-poo the thing, you know.
Well,
so to be able to do it in power and just walk away after is awesome.
And this area of ownership is very important for each person, because the more that we actually receive and acknowledge our greatness and our light, the happier we become.
Yes.
And I know the basic conditioning of society is that it's, you know, it's selfish and wrong to take a compliment, or at least not give one back. And truly, a compliment is a gift, and to receive the gift is very respectful. Not only that, again, owning that is owning, you know, owning our greatness, owning our special gift, and that resonates inside of us, and then we become more joyful, and then the fabric of goodwill is strengthened, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all little levels of ownership that go on here, and the common thread here is this creation of freedom inside the body.
Yes. Yes, it is that welling that was always there, the thing that makes you... I'm 35 now, and I find myself crying more than I ever have before, but not out of fear or anxiety, but just sometimes something's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but kind of tear up, and then I laugh because it's so great. And
but you're connected to that, and you're comfortable.
Yeah, there's a connection. It's so perfect. It was always there. There's always been, you know, people helping one another out. But now when I see it, since I believe it, I believe that it's inherently who we are, I can get the power from it and not mind, you know, just tearing up a bit, not feel lame or emasculated
sure.
or whatever else. So that's a gift, and that's something we should all work for, and I continue to. I want to just cry and laugh all day.
It sounds like a good life to me.
That'd be perfect, wouldn't it?
Well, thank you for calling in, Keith, and sharing your thoughts. I certainly feel inspired.
Cool. And I love what you guys are doing here. Keep it up, and I'll tell my friends to listen.
Terrific.
Absolutely.
Thanks, buddy.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
Bye. We have...
that was great.
A great guy. I know. Dweller on the Threshold.
Yeah, that's a wonderful... You know, I was just talking to my mother yesterday about those little gems that she used to give us as children, and not realizing, certainly as kids, how much those little gems impacted us unconsciously. And now as adults, consciously knowing how they really have impacted us. And it's beautiful. And I was giving my mother... as we were just talking about, a compliment yesterday and thanking her for some of those. I just randomly called her out of the blue. I was leaving my house at 5:30 in the morning, and the sun was rising over the hills, and it was so beautiful. And I looked up at the sky, and it just was in amazement and how beautiful it was. And I actually spoke to the sky, and I said, "Wow, you are amazing." And I started giggling to myself. I said, "Wow, that's my mom." And I called her at that moment. Now, she wasn't open. She wasn't awake, and she lived on the East Coast. But I left a message on her machine and said what just I experienced. And later on, she called me, and I thanked her for being this beacon of light in our lives while growing up, and not knowing how much the kinds of things that she shared with us as children impacted us in a positive way. And now I can share it with her how much they have.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Gems. Mom's gems.
They are.
I know.
They are truly the
Everybody
jewels.
Has gems, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
So we have just like a minute left, and I would love for you to just give us a brief end thought on the word able, and we can talk about it further at another time.
Well, The thing that keeps coming to my mind is I'm actually sitting in my car at this very moment, and I see this blue placard in front of me, and it's actually called a disabled placard.
Mm-hmm.
And I so do not connect with that word, disabled. I mean, all of the things that I do in my life, you know, my sports, my motivational speaking, traveling all over around the world, and my training clients, I am more able than most people who have all four limbs working perfectly.
Yeah.
So I tend not to use those words, nor do I use words like, you know, I don't believe what happened to me is an accident. I believe everything happens for a reason.
Sure.
And I don't connect with many of the typical words that people use. You know, when I speak about what happened, I said I hit the ground at 100 miles an hour. That's it. Using a word like the word able is not something that I consciously would use. If I were in the midst of a conversation and I said it unconsciously, I might retract it and say use a different word.
Sure.
Something that connects with me a little bit more.
Well, you are, Jeremy, in my opinion, one of the most able-bodied people I know, and I think you're bigger than your reasons, and I am blessed to have you in my life, and I look forward to seeing how you move, touch, and inspire others, and thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate you, Janet.
Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate everybody listening and BBS Radio and the opportunity to inspire as many people as possible through the internet radio. I appreciate and have gratitude for the internet. And my name, again, is Janet Kaleri, and my website is siteforsound.com. And I welcome any feedback or questions. and have an amazing, create an amazing, extraordinary day for yourself. So long.
That's when it is.